Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive, the hat out front. Should tell you, I've done a lot of radio around here, about 30 years, and this is going to be as good a piece as we've ever done around here. It's all brought to you by our friends at Taharka Wake and Bake. You will not need to worry about waking in this segment. We have professionals here for that. Made in Baltimore, the good stuff. I'm almost out of the Mintflix and the vanilla bean. It's because my wife hasn't been here. I'm eating it all. State Fair is where we would gather for this type of gathering for Baltimore Positive, as well as some of the other great podcasts here in the state of Maryland. But we would do it at State Fair, probably over some shrimp and grits or some chicken and waffles. We would do it socially distanced, or maybe we would do it down at Fadley's for some crab cakes. You can ship them all over the world, find them out of Fadley's and Fadley's Crab Cakes online. And, of course, Moeller & Gary Realty. House goes on the market, house sells. Simple as that. Go to Moeller & Gary Realty. Don, I'm going to allow you to do the honors because this is your baby, and the minute you sent me that we were calling this Election Palooza, I'm like, we've just screwed up the trademark. Somebody's got that copyrighted. We're going to jail before this is over. But this is Election Palooza, so you have at it, my friend.
Well, it was pretty easy to come up with this idea, Nestor. You reach out to some of the smartest people, some of the people doing some of the best podcasts in the entire state. And when you get Candace Dodson Reed and Tom Cole from Elevate Maryland, and you get Ryan Miner from A Minor Detail, and special guest tonight, the legendary, the iconic Mark Steiner.
He's too cool for a podcast. He didn't need a podcast.
That's just the Steiner. Only because I'm old.
Just the Steiner show. And we're going to be here about once a month leading up to what we think is the most important election of our time. We're going to talk about that, whether it is, whether it isn't. We're going to try not to talk over each other. And with that, Candace, I want to throw it to you because you have something you want to start by talking about that will really get us into, I think, a really interesting area.
I do. And thank you for having us on the show with this great lineup. Next time we're going to work on getting a couple more women, so I'm not alone. I know we have that planned, and so I'm excited about that. But before we get started talking about the election, I wanted just to talk about one thing. Ryan and I recently had a really great conversation about some challenging comments that Ryan made as a college student. And I don't want to get into the details about that, but I wanted to give Ryan an opportunity to talk a bit about growth and change. And why I think this is really important and an important conversation and to talk about such growth and tell the stories that lead to progress is because it's the only way that we can heal and grow as a community and a nation. And so I thought it was a good way to start off with this. Not everyone changes in this way. There are extremes everywhere, as we know, but Ryan did. And like, I'd like to turn it over to Ryan for a minute to talk about that as we get into a conversation that will be about hopefully change and growth in November.
Okay, there's my mic.
You're all good. We got
all
you.
All right. Thank you. And thank you, Candace and Nestor, Tom, Don, and Mark. And thank you for having me tonight. And Candace is right. On Monday afternoon, we had a great conversation. And Candace and I had not previously connected before this, maybe a few times tangentially, but still, we had a conversation where she and just let me say this, what I love about Candace is she's very direct, and when she asks you a straight question, you give her a straight answer, and that's important. And so where this conversation, where I want to tell you just a little story, and then we'll talk politics. But back, you know, I grew up in Western Maryland, a very culturally conservative place. Hagerstown, to be exact, and I lived in a community halfway between Williamsport and Hagerstown. And growing up in Western Maryland, where it was, I was raised in a Catholic family with one side of the family was Baptist and like close to Mennonite, and my other side was hardcore Catholic. I settled on going to Duquesne University and Catholic, of course. And when I got there, I was a young kid, a big fish out of water. It was probably going to a city like Pittsburgh was the most diverse place that I've ever been. And I grew up, like I said, very culturally conservative. And then I got to Pittsburgh, and when I got to college, Facebook didn't even exist. Now it came into an emergence, and here I am, like a kid, not knowing anything about life. And I made some comments that were anti-gay, and they were harmful. And I went through a process in my university where some students talked to me and brought them up to our university and said, this guy's comments are really hurtful and he needs to own that and take responsibility. So I did some interviews, and then it just kind of devolved from there. And the comments back then, I didn't know what I was saying. I said something because I thought I wanted to be pithy, and I thought that, hey, I'm this rock-ribbed conservative from Western Maryland. I didn't know anything. I was young and stupid, and really, I don't know what I was aiming for. I don't know what I was going for, but it turns out that these comments catch up with you. And if you're in college and you're listening now, just remember that anything you say, it will be held against you, and especially in the internet. But really, these comments should have caught up with me because it forced a lot of internal conversations. And so I didn't, you know, I said these anti-gay comments, and then fast forward 5 years later, I was heading one morning to a cafe in Williamsport, never been there before. And I sat down at the counter, and the woman, her name's Rose, and she won't mind me telling this story. I sat down and we talked about our conversation. So several times I visited later, and Rose finally said, maybe about 6 months after, she goes, you know, I know what you said in college. And she goes, I don't know if you know, but the other woman that you see often in here, that we're not just friends, but we're married. And I said, oh, I said, I had no idea. And she's like, well, you must have the worst gaydar I have ever seen in my life. And I'm like, what's that mean? And she's like, Ryan, she goes, we're gay, we're married. And I said, oh, okay. And, you know, I think that was the moment. And she looked at me and she goes, I love you. I think that you are a phenomenal person. I just want to help you grow. And as she was telling me her story about the struggles that she went through, I had tears running down my eyes because it was so impactful. And she says, I know that you probably didn't mean to say the things that you did, but let me help you understand why they're hurtful and what you can do to change. And so I think at that moment was pivotal for me. It was one of the most profoundly impactful moments of my life. And I reflected, I had a lot of internal conversations, and I own what I said, and it still catches up with me 15 years later, but every day is a new opportunity to understand people, to take into your hearts that we're all just people. And I learned so many valuable lessons moving forward from there. And where I am today on LGBTQ issues, I have a lot of friends who are in the LGBT community. My wife and I are very supportive. We donate to causes, and I look back, and I want to be straight up with everyone on here. And I think that part of reason why we do podcasts is to extrapolate honesty in real moments from people. So I look back on that kid at 19 years old, and I think, what the heck is wrong with you? Why would you say that? Why would you, what would inspire you to say something as awful and mean and just destructive? And the honest answer is I don't know. Maybe I wanted attention. Maybe I wanted to show that I had these conservative bona fides. Maybe I just wanted to be a rebel for all the wrong reasons. And now that I'm 34, almost 35 in 3 months, with kids and a wonderful wife, it's embarrassing and it's hurtful. But as I was telling Candace, there's this word called grace, and I didn't really understand it until it was given to me. And when people give you grace to say, I know you've made a mistake, but we're going to love you either way, and we're going to allow you to evolve, and you might be stubborn, but we're going to allow you to keep moving forward. And I think that the grace that my friend Rose gave me, who was at our wedding, and we see her all the time and still text and call each other, I think that grace saved me in so many ways. And I'm just thankful that it did, because I can't imagine if I had to live that hate in my heart now. And I'm just glad that Candace gave me an opportunity to talk to her like a real person, where we can have real conversations. That's the pivotal work. That's the cultural work that I think that we can all benefit from.
Thank you. I appreciate you doing this, and I appreciated our conversation. And let's talk politics.
Let's talk. Okay. Well, you know, I think it's a great, in a way, Ryan, and I thank you as well. I think it's an interesting segue, because the first question that I jotted down, I'm trying to think, would Donald Trump even understand the kinds of emotions and feelings and growth that you just described. I think I asked that rhetorically because I think I know what we think. My question is, Mark, and maybe you start us off as the elder statesman here and the historian, how the hell did we get here? How did we get Donald Trump?
Well, that's a long story, but I'll try to make it as quick and pithy as humanly possible here. And I mean that. I mean, this is a long trail. I mean, I think that, you know, Don, when we were growing up, we grew up in a land of Dick and Jane, which was a kid's book that kids used to read about this lovely little white family and a white picket fence that everybody had in their school. And we grew up with George Washington chopping down the cherry tree and all these myths about who we were. And I think that the beginning of the civil rights movement, the push to end segregation in this country, people opened their eyes to what they used to call prejudice, but racism in this country, it exploded during the civil rights movement and in the 1960s and the Vietnam War and the women's movement and the environmental movement, and things began to really shift in the United States that kind of began to tear at the fabric of the nation. And I think that we're still fighting and reeling from that time 50, 60 years ago at this moment. And this is what we're building to. And I think that you're seeing a country that is really doesn't know who it is anymore. We don't know who we are. And we're all trying to define it. And I think that this this anger around, there was a lot of anger in lots of parts of America when Obama won. How could this black man be president of the United States? He wasn't even born here. Where's he from? He's from Kenya. He's not from the United States. And so there was this real anger being built up in this country on all sides. And I think that there was a disappointment in the Obama administration on some levels. Don't have to get into all that right now, but I think that this led the way to Donald Trump taking over. Look, Donald Trump, I mean, this to show the absolute anger of the American people to elect somebody who I have a bunch of friends who voted for Donald Trump, people I really care about. My next door neighbor is one of them. I mean, something goes wrong in his house, I'm on his roof. Something goes wrong in my house, he's under the house helping me fix the plumbing. I mean, you know, we like that. But he's a Trumpster. And I often say to him, man, you go to church every Sunday. And you believe in what you believe in. And yet you're going to vote for somebody who was so deeply misogynist, who said the most racist things, who talked about grabbing women by their private parts, and you voted for him? I mean, what? And you know, and so I think that we've come to a point where we're trying to redefine what America means, and I think that's why you get a Donald Trump. We it's a resistance to the changes taking place. It's a resistance to the fact that that we realize we are not a white Christian nation. We never have been. We always defined ourselves that way. That's not who we are. And there's resistance against realizing we're a different place. And I think I'm really worried about where the country is going. No matter who wins this election, I'm worried about where the country is going. I'm more worried if Donald Trump runs, I'm really worried about where this country is going. But no matter where we go, I'm really concerned for the future of this country. I think we have lost our way. We're not sure who we are anymore.
Yeah, I mentioned a couple of weeks ago on here that I literally, and I'm trying to think of anyone even now in my life who voted for Donald Trump who has renounced it. I don't have any. I have a lot of people. I have friends just today that work along with Goodyear Tires, right? So here's a company, you know, hundreds of thousands of people sell Goodyear tires, you know, put them on cars. It's an American company. How many of those people voted for Donald Trump, and how many people that morning that the tweet comes out says, well, you know, he's not, you know, but he's still my guy. He's got a red hat. He's my guy. I don't know what changes between now and whenever the ballots come or don't come, or they screw up the postal service and the mail doesn't get sorted, or he disputes the election. But I'm shocked that 3 years and 9 months basically into this, that I haven't had one next door neighbor, Mark or any of you, in the Archie Bunker wave that I grew up in Dundalk that I did not realize until Facebook, until November of 2016. How many people I went to high school, and Dom was my guidance counselor at Dundalk High School in 1982, supported this guy, but then 4 years later, after we're all wearing masks, after 25% of your friends are unemployed, you know, you're waiting on money, you're, whatever the situation would be, that you would not want to vote for him again, or would want to consider, you know, Joe and Kamala, or third party. I mean, I just not him. I haven't heard anybody saying, "Man, I'm not going to do it this time. I'm sorry that I made a mistake." And I that's the part that really shocks me this far into it, because like you, Mark, I thought I had sensible Republican friends that thought of themselves as somebody that would support Kasich or Bush or a typical, you know, Republican, I would say, a Reagan Republican. This is a whole different George Wallace kind of thing that for all of my lifetime, I've often wondered, who would have voted for that guy? Well, these are the children and grandchildren, and in some cases, the grown-up 15-year-old 1968 that's still supporting Donald Trump. I'm sort of blown away that people haven't backed off of it. And Ryan, you talk about changing, and Candace as well. I thought there would be more of that, more people who met their rose, who said, I have a this or a that, or this is wrong, or what he said is wrong, or what he's tweeted is wrong, or holding a Bible upside down, or gassing America, all it lies, Ukraine, Russia, all of these things, something in there would make you say, I'm not going to vote for him this time. And the scary part that we're all here is I don't think any of us have enough of those people in our life that say, I'm going to go with Joe this time.
Yeah, I mean, I made a joke before we got on today. Mark, you might recognize my last name and know that I do have people in my life that that aren't Trump supporters. But, you know, and this is hard for me to say, but I'm going to say it anyway. I think prior to the 2016 election, we somehow allowed this narrative to go through that you could support Donald Trump without a racist bone in your body, that this was not a racial candidate. And there was a big effort by national media and books that came out to make the election about the forgotten working class and about the Midwest and all of that. But right now, after 4 years, you cannot say, you don't necessarily have to be a racist to vote for Donald Trump, but you can't be an anti-racist and vote for Donald Trump. You cannot actually be trying to move our country in a positive direction when it comes to race relations and vote for a man who equates poverty with race, who equates affordable housing with race. Now, we know that those two things are related due to segregation policies, but he is looking to put those policies back into place proudly in a way to pitch himself in a more blatant way to white voters. So I agree with everything Mark says. I think that having Barack Obama elected president of the United States made certain people think that something was at stake that they needed to defend. And even though Donald Trump, I mean, to Nestor, your point, Donald Trump didn't win the majority of the electorate last time. And with, as a former First Lady Michelle Obama, as she said the other day, I think two votes per precinct in one state would have changed it. We just need those states to vote the right way this time.
Michigan, let me just throw a bomb in here, let other people talk. It's one of the things I think, this is how dangerous situations I think we're facing. There are two parts of history that I keep been reading a lot about and thinking about in terms of where we are now. One's 1877. 1877 was a man named Rutherford B. Hayes became president of the United States with a minority of the vote, because the redemptionist Democrats, who were the Confederates, and moderate Republicans who didn't like the radical Republicans who pushed the end of slavery and fought for Reconstruction, they decided that Rutherford B. Hayes was going to be president if he would end Reconstruction. There's a lot of debate in historically what Reconstruction means. One of the things Reconstruction was a blooming interracial democracy in the South. And it was ended. And that began 90 years of abject terror against Black people. It began the putting of Native people on reservations and the move against the white industrial working class that was moving into cities and repressing KSM to stop unions from growing. That's what was launched in 1877. And then the other thing I think about is 1932, Germany, when Adolf Hitler won with the Nazi Party, won with a minority of the vote. They won because liberals, people on the left, moderates, could not come together to say no, to stop it. And I think we are at that equally dangerous moment in this country. People say it can't happen here. It can happen here. It's happened in Black communities already. It's happened in Mexican communities. It's happened to lots of communities in this country. And I think that people are in a panic because we are a deindustrialized nation and people are losing their jobs right and left. We say working class. People think of white working class. No, the working class in America, now the majority of working class people in America are not even white. So,
Dennis, what do you think about all this?
Yeah, I mean, I think two things. One, I think Mark's point about the election of President Obama was a point in this country where, you know, folks who are racist and folks who don't want to see Black people succeed at that level, who are looking at this Black man who's Ivy League educated and his Black wife who are Ivy League educated, rejected that, right? And so Donald Trump gets in because they rejected that. And I think we have to call it what it is. It is racism. And the second point I'll make is that, you know, there are some Republicans who are, you know, I'm never on a show talking about like go Republicans, but there are some Republicans who are rebuking this foolishness. And we need to be clear to say that. If you have Republican friends who are not, they are racist. I'm sorry. They are buying into what Donald Trump is selling. And I was like, there's no other way to call it anything else. There are children who are brown in cages at the border. I mean, it feels like that was like 700 years ago, right? That happened. That is still the case. There are plenty of dog whistles. There are plenty of overt things that happen. We all heard what happened in Charlottesville. I mean, come on, there are good people on both sides. I mean, that is racist. And if you do not rebuke him as our president, and I'm not even talking about all of the illegal things. I mean, we can get into that later. I'm talking about the simple disdain for Black and brown people, people of color. The man is racist, and he got into power because folks could not stand to see a successful Black man and a successful Black woman succeed at the highest level in this country. And we can get into the politics of Obama. I don't agree with everything that he did. Of course, no one does. But people could not stand that and came out in crazy numbers, kind of. Like, we can talk about that too, to support a full-blown racist man. We knew this, by the way, on the campaign trail. Like, people who were saying, oh, you know, maybe he gets in there and does things better. Excuse me. We knew this on the campaign trail. It was not a shock to me at all. And the last thing I'll say about this right now is, you know, look at the history of this country. I mean, I keep recommending to people 1619, right? The podcast and the piece, the written piece that came out in the New York Times Magazine. I mean, there's a history here that Black people have experienced that's very different than anyone else. And so if you're struggling with systemic racism and struggling with, you know, why this is such a challenge for Black people in this country after 400 years of oppression, read 1619, listen to the podcast so that you can educate yourself and understand the history of our country, because it's awful. It's awful. And that's why we're here right now again. And again, history repeats itself, right? We were here before. I keep telling the story where my dad, who marched with King and was very active in the civil rights movement, you know, said to me recently, he's like, oh my God, I like did all of these things so that, you know, we weren't born clearly, but like, so that my kids didn't have to do this thing. My future kids did not have to do this kind of stuff. And here we are again. And I said to my dad, I'm like, look, I love that you did that and I appreciate that, but here's where we are. And so how do we now move away from this just toxic situation in our country that is literally taking all of us down into something where we can try to recover? And to Mark's point, I don't know how you do that because we're down in the dumps.
Well, before we throw it, Ryan, and I want to come to you in just a second because as a child of Western Maryland, I really want you have many friends, relatives, loved ones out there. I really want you to give us the Western Maryland perspective in just a second. But, you know, Candace, when you were talking and you cut right to the chase, and I watched Nestor, he gets a gleam in his eye because he likes it when people – we invented a new word the other day, the no baloney approach to all this.
Malarkey. And, malarkey.
No malarkey. And the fact that you cut – right to the chase, because I go back. There are a couple things I think about, and Tom, you said it. If you're voting for this man, you're a racist. That's the bottom line. And
That's a really hard thing to do, to go to every person in my high school class and call them racist, though. It is. It's difficult. Well, it's very difficult.
But think back to it. I remember this moment. It was back during the height of the birther controversy, which was purely a Donald Trump creation. I mean, it was out there on the fringes of the web, but he's great at going to the fringes of the web and making that stuff mainstream and then tapping into this underbelly of the United States. But I remember Chris Matthews said, if you don't think it's racist, step back and think about this for a moment. By any traditional standard, this family checks all the boxes. This family is the American dream. Young girl from the south side of Chicago. Lots of people living in one house. Barack Obama could have gone to Wall Street and made millions of dollars, but instead goes out and becomes a community organizer and drives a beat up VW Beetle. They have two children that are gorgeous. They both go to Harvard Law. One becomes the editor of the Harvard Law Review. They appear to have this wonderful marriage. Check, 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 until we get to the last box. Are they white? There's no other explanation, because they're as leave it to Beaver as anything there is other than the last blocks. Yeah, Tom and Ryan.
That's a question for Nestor and Ryan, because it's going to feed into them. This is something I don't get. Nestor, you just said it. It's hard to call everyone in my high school racist. Why is it right now that it is harder and more difficult to call out racism than it is to tell someone they're stupid? Because we call each other stupid online all the time. But as soon as you say racist, it's some terribly offensive thing. And it's preventing us from having the conversation. So that's for, and Ryan, it's because I think you're going to have a lot of good insight on this, but it's for both Nestor and Ryan.
Go ahead, Ryan.
So, you know, to complex issues here. And I really appreciate Candace's point of view. And I think, you know, I think I'm a movie buff. I'm sure like many of you. And one of my favorite movies was Aaron Sorkin, who, by the way, is like over-dramatizes everything. But in many ways, the last great thing he's done was The Newsroom. And I love The Newsroom. And I repeat quips from that all the time. But one of Aaron Sorkin's greatest movies ever made was, it was released in 1995, and it was called The American President. And Andrew Shepherd, played by the great Michael Douglas, made this infamous speech where he walks out into the White House press room. And he said, he made this wonderful speech, and it ended up where he ended by talking about a gun bill. And at the time, it was a pretty progressive thing. Think back in the 90s. But he says, we have serious problems to solve, and we need serious people to solve them. And whatever your particular problem is, I can promise you that Bob Rumson is not the least bit interested in solving it. He's interested in two things and two things only, making you afraid of it and telling you who to blame for it. And he said that, ladies and gentlemen, is how you win elections. You gather a group of middle-aged, middle-class, middle-income voters who remember the longing for an easier time, and you talk to them about family and American values and character. And then you tell them who to blame, who is to blame for their lot in life, and then you go on television. And so think about that. And growing up in Western Maryland, there are some truly decent people. To answer your question first, Tom, about why people are afraid to call out racism, it's just because, you know, that's a great question. And I think a lot of it has to do with that we're just afraid to do it. We're just afraid to do it. It's a tough conversation. And to say to your relative or to your Uncle Tim or your, you know, your Aunt Mary that, you know, what you're saying is racist, that's a really tough conversation, even though you see them posting wacky things. You see them doing things that you're like, why do you believe this? You know, and let me just bring it back to my own family, because God love them. I don't always understand my father, and I try to. But back in late April, my dad started, and my dad's not like a political guy. He's a 54-year-old guy. He didn't go to college, manages a carpet warehouse. He has a lot of talents that I don't have. He's a good human being. He'd do anything for anybody. But the fact is that his politics, or how he kind of got enveloped in these politics, is just weird. He was posting anti-Fauci stuff. And I would then comment on his status that he thought, you think it's a big hoax, a conspiracy. And I said, Dad, you know, it's really offensive that you're saying these things. You know that in my professional career, I'm the director of business development for a home care agency in Montgomery County. So I work with senior citizens. I have been on the phones with families who just lost their loved ones, who had to talk to them through a computer screen as they take their last breath, lay dying in a memory care community. And we have to talk to them and make sense of COVID. That is one of the truly most brutal things that I've ever had to do. And it's really hard to go at home at night and look your wife and kids in the face with a smile. And I asked my dad, why did you do this? So one morning in late April, he calls me up, just starts shouting at me early in the morning. And I'm like, not even half awake. And he's like, he says, you're an elitist. You are, you know, a lot of people that I know think that you're wrong. You know, you judge and criticize people. Not everyone thinks like you do. You're a left-wing lunatic from Montgomery County. And I'm like, are you kidding me, Dad? And from, I can't remember the date. It was late April. From that moment on, we haven't spoken.
Wow.
I haven't talked to my father even on Father's Day. It's brutal. It eats at me alive. My mother, who God love, you know, my parents are separated a long time ago. You know, people are like, well, you know, you really should call your dad. And I said, you know what? You're probably right. But this time, I just...
Well, beliefs are the hardest thing in the world to change, right? I mean, he has beliefs. You know what I mean? Values and beliefs. And people who are conservative by their very nature, and I don't think anybody on this panel, the part of being conservative that I think we have a hard time understanding is conservative means I will never change. I won't change no matter what. This is who I am. All of that dogma that doesn't necessarily make sense when you break it down and you say, why do you believe that? And they can't answer it.
Because it feels right, they say. It feels right.
Well, it certainly, I have a friend in my life who I would say 85% of his world is still saturated in red hats, not blue hats. He's not a red hat. He's not a blue hat. He's a guy trying to figure out his way in the world, right? But 4 out of 5 people in his life that are at every table in every conversation, his neighbors think this way. That is part of the pressure of growing up in Archie Bunker's Dundalk, where my father would have been 101 years old now, right? So I grew up in a whole different way, where my father was from Scranton, Pennsylvania. My mother was from the Deep South. My mother had help around the house, and it took me until I was 45 years old to realize, oh, South Carolina, you know, the 1919 she was born. So that's where I came from. And then I went to school at Dundalk, and I've told all the stories with Don. And Don finally admitted, and you can speak to this. Don, you were my high school guidance counselor. I met you on the first day in 1982 where you were in Dundalk High School, and you finally admitted maybe 2 months ago on our podcast that you weren't teaching social studies there or math, that your biggest challenge was what in 1982 with Dundalk High? You said managing race. You said that.
Because it came up. That's an interesting point. Boy, this is, if you're just joining us, you're tuning in, you're listening to a joint podcast. We thank some of our best friends, truly, in Maryland media. We have Candace Dodson Reed and Tom Cole from Elevate Maryland, Ryan Miner from the outstanding A Minor Detail, and as we said, the legendary Mark Steiner. Nestor, thanks for raising that point, Nestor, because I don't know if this is where we intended to go with episode one of this, but it certainly is. It certainly is compelling.
Well, we're talking about
me.
Electing a president here. That, you know, that really this is the heart of the issue of how we're going to change voters, how someone in a red hat's going to vote blue this time or not vote or whatever's going to happen that's going to create change in our country, right?
And here's the point that Nestor was alluding to, and Mark, you can really jump in and talk about your experiences, and maybe you can even relive for us your experience about being the only white kid in the Black Boy Scout troop, because that's one of my favorite Steiner stories. But Nestor was commenting, I don't know if it was when we had Tim Tootin on or whoever, but we were talking about race and high school education. It may have been with one of the superintendents. And Nestor
it was Barry Williams, by the way, is what it
Barry
was.
Barry Williams, that's Barry who it was. That's who it was, Barry Williams, former area superintendent in the Baltimore City Public Schools and director of
famous sister
Rec and Parks. His sister has a pretty pretty important job in Annapolis. And as proud as Candace is about to tell us, the Speaker of the House happens to be a proud UMBC graduate. So I'll throw that in before Candace does. But we were talking, and Nestor said, you know, it was interesting. I came from Hollabird, and there really weren't a lot of racial problems at Dundalk High School. And my eyes popped open. I was a young assistant principal, guidance counselor, and then assistant principal. And I said, Nestor, say that again. He said, well, there just really weren't a lot of racial problems at Dundalk High. I said, Nestor, we spent...
That's not the story I told everyone, but by the way, I...
90%. Oh, I'm going to let you correct it, but 90% of our time and energy was spent on creating relationships and building racial bridges, because at Dundalk High, back in the early 80s, we had the school coming from two feeders, Dundalk Middle School and Hollabird Middle. Dundalk Middle School had Turner Station, extremely diverse community, students who had been together, white and black, from elementary school up through middle school. Hollabird, the white kids at Hollabird, I think you said, Nestor, that you had never had a black student in your class.
There was never a black person in my neighborhood. There was never a black person in my elementary or my middle school. And it took me until I was 40 years old to figure out why, and reading Antero Padilla's books and, you know, figuring out how that happened. But what I told you was in the 70s, I believed I was going to Kenwood, and they redistrict. And in my neighborhood, the Archie Bunker Dundalk in 1979, the thought that you were going to go to school at Dundalk meant that you were going to go to school with black kids. At Kenwood, it wasn't that's where all my older brothers, all the older kids in the neighborhood went. And the Dundalk flag went up and the racism flag went up. And there was, in May 1st of 1981, I remember there was going to be a revolutionary May Day. All of our parents were freaked out, weren't sending us to school. I'm 12, 13 years old. And now I'm going to Dundalk High, where I met Don Mohler on the first day. That was the story. The story was that Donald Trump has brought back these thoughts of the 70s and early 80s about why things were the way they were. And it's taken me more than half a lifetime to sort of add it all up. Candace, getting back to the beginning as to how was your childhood different than mine, just based on where you were and the color of your skin. That's the American story, I think, for all of us. And Donald Trump is, how did we get here? That we have a lot of misunderstanding, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that in hearing this conversation. And when I think about, you know, sort of the work I do in my professional life and consulting life, it's, you know, it is very difficult. It's easy to hear someone on the TV or read someone's tweets or hear or read some foolishness in the history books about black people and buy into these stereotypes without actually having a conversation. Because at the end of the day, what you find is that most black people want the same thing that everybody else wants, right? And so I often find that the problem is, like, you know, Nestor, you talked about not knowing any black folks. Like, folks who don't know black folks, who have not sat down with black people, who don't have friends who are people of color and don't have the important conversations about sort of where the commonalities are and also where the difference is. Cause like this whole, I don't see color thing. No, I don't, like, don't ever say that to me ever, ever, ever. Like, I'm a black woman. It is clear. Please see me as that and understand my lived experience. But like, you know, I want folks to have the conversation with me, like understand that the things that I want for my kid are the same things that most people want for their children. I want a house. I want, you know, running water. I want healthy water. I don't want to live in Flint, Michigan, where it's still a darn issue in 2020. Like, you know, the basic things that people want, there's certainly commonality there, but we don't ever get to the conversation. And people chide me about this. Tom even laughed at me a little bit about like sitting down and having coffee with people, but and I don't want to have it with them. Nice. I'm nice, but I don't do it with the extremes now. I don't do it with the like, car, right?
Well, you know, Candace, we've got to get Mark to jump in here with a perspective, because Mark, Candace and Tom and Ryan may not know this story. Nestor does. One of my favorite Mark Steiner stories is they had a big birthday celebration for Mark a few years ago, and people came from all over the United States to sing his praises. And Mark's obviously been a civil rights advocate for decades. And one of the African-American speakers got up and he said, I used to get the biggest kick out of Mark because we'd be at a rally and Mark would be saying, and the man's doing this and the man's doing that and the white man's doing this. And he said, I finally turned to Mark and I said, Mark, you do know you're a white man, right? Is that accurate, Mark?
He said something close enough.
So, Mark, tell us about your experiences as a civil rights activist way back when, all the way through the 60s. And now here we are in 2020. And as Nestor said and as Candace said, we're having the same discussions, Mark.
Well, we're having similar discussions. I mean, I think that people don't. The people don't really understand, I think, the depth of racism in our society and where it comes from. You know, I mean, if you think about, I wrote this piece not long ago just about how, you know, anti-Semitism has been with us since the 300s, in the beginning of the Catholic Church, and when the edicts were put out, and that has permeated the consciousness of the world. Racism in its modern form, you know, it actually came out of the 15th century, when the beginning of the slave trade, and they had to come up with an ideology that was actually borrowed from the ideology that created anti-Semitism, literally in the Iberian Peninsula, and then was turned into excuses that Africans were less than human, so they could be enslaved en masse. Even though every society had slavery, this was fundamentally different, and so. It is part of the consciousness of the world now. I mean, it's hard to root out. So 1960, you know, the beginning of the civil rights movement, I was 14, and when I walked my first picket line, and that was because I had been by total happenstance, I ended up being the only white boy in an all-black Boy Scout troop in 1957, that Don was alluding to, and it was because of my mother, who was a Brit, who hated racism. She came to this country, was flabbergasted. She gave when they got married in 1944, she gave my father, black boy, Richard Wright, who he'd understand his country better. That was my mom. And so when I came to be a Boy Scout, which led to the civil rights movement, I'll make it quick. When I came to be a Boy Scout, I ran downstairs to the kitchen and said, Mama, I got to be a Boy Scout. I mean, I'll be 11 years old in 2 weeks. You know, I need to sign up right away. And so my mother said, all right, love, we'll sign you up straight away. Monday morning, Beth Tefillah, which was a synagogue around the corner. And we would go to that Boy Scout troop. I said, no, Mom, I want a Boy Scout troop with all kinds of kids. Well, that didn't exist. 57 was segregated Baltimore. And long story short, what happened was every day before the end of the day, there was a black woman, like most white families had in Baltimore, worked in their home. Mrs. Moselle Jackson and her nephew, Mr. Dennis Foster, would pick her up every day. And they were all having coffee and cake. And Mr. Foster said, I'm a scoutmaster, you can join my troop. And my mother said, and I remember this twinkle in her eyes, she looked up and she looked down and she went, oh, that's a lovely idea. She knew exactly what she was doing. And so I ended up at the Faith Baptist Church in East Baltimore. And that's where I first experienced the depth of racism in America, on all kinds of levels, especially when we went to Boy Scout camp. I remember driving, and first of all, I remember I called Mrs. Jackson Moselle. I called Mr. Foster Dennis. I was 11 years old. Got to the church. It was Mr. Foster and Mrs. Jackson. That really hit me. I realized that I call all white people by their last name if they're adults, but not black people. I call them by their first name. And then we went to get donuts. And one day after troop, and I was sitting in the back of his Mercury. All the guys piled out of the car. I stayed there. And he leaned in the window and said, no, Mark, you don't understand. Wherever we can go, you can go. And I remember being turned away from the Forest Theater with my friend Edwin Johnson, who was later became an auto worker, and was a city councilman for a while, and was a Black Panther later in life. And we're still best buddies since 1957. And he used to come visit me. And when he used to come visit me, we couldn't get in the movie theater. We couldn't go to a restaurant. We couldn't buy a hot dog. I went to visit him, and everybody accepted me. He came to visit me. The white kids in my neighborhood didn't accept Edwin back in the late 50s. So all these things kept tumbling out. And so I was 14, and we were at Mondawmin Shopping Center, which was mostly white and Jewish. And there were all these black students picketing the White Coffee Pot, which is a coffee, which is a chain of restaurants back in that day. And I asked my mother if I could join the picket line. And she said, well, we'll go ask the picket captain. We did. And from that moment on, I was in the civil rights movement and became the youngest person arrested for civil rights in Maryland at almost 16. When I was beaten and tortured by the police in Cambridge, literally. And my life has been engulfed in fighting civil rights and racism since I was a little boy. And what
does it shock you that Trump's come into the world?
No, not at all. I mean, look, we're for the first time in America, I think, with the death of George Floyd, the murder of George Floyd, and the ones that happened around Breonna Taylor and the others were killed around the same time that George Floyd was, and starting with Trayvon Martin. We are seeing, for the first time in my life, I'm seeing masses of white people who are beginning to understand that racism is wrong and how deep it is. You've seen these demonstrations out there against racism around the country. There are hundreds of thousands of white people in the street. This is new. This is something really different.
To build up.
Can I just bring it full circle real quick? Can I just bring it really
quick? Please. Go. I'll stop. Please stop.
Go. You heard what Mark said, and you listen to that history, and you understand the history of this country. That is why you've got to talk to your neighbor who is still voting for Donald Trump. That's why. In understanding the history of our country, and understanding that this racism is a systemic issue, that is not new. It didn't happen just because folks are recognizing that George Floyd was murdered when someone stood on his neck. This is a historical issue. And that is why you have to talk to your neighbors. That's why.
If I could,
Tom, you were trying to jump in.
Yeah, I want to build off of what Mark was saying because I want to work in some pop culture. There's a great—
Tom, can you turn your mic up just a little bit for me just so I can hear you a little better? Go ahead.
What's that?
Turn your mic up just a little.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Normally I'm too
loud. Or stay on it, but it's okay. It's all good.
So there's a great new show on HBO called Lovecraft County.
Oh, yeah.
And it's made like it's a horror show, but it really is a big metaphor about race in the 1960s. And one of the pivotal scenes, and I'm not giving away anything, is that there are these monsters that are tearing people apart. And this guy gets attacked. He's a police sheriff, a racist, that goes into this shed with two black men. And he says, we got to stay in here. And they said, there's monsters out there. He says, there's no monsters. Meanwhile, he's been attacked. And it's all about how there are monsters. And it is unsafe for some people where we see safety. And so and when I say we, I mean white folks. We see safety, and that's why we want to say there is no racism. That's why we want to say I don't see race, because that is what we live. And meanwhile, there are monsters out there. And Esther, to your question of like Trump being elected, and to Mark's point of like we're now having a reckoning, is that now everybody, or at least I think a good segment of the population, see the monsters. There have been people like Candace that have said there are monsters out there, and people have been like, no, everything. I mean, maybe you're blowing it up too much. And I was joking with Candace about like, we talk about race a lot on our show. And I love that, you know, this group, we've talked about it a lot, because like, it's about having that inclusive conversation to just acknowledge the monsters. And to go back to my question before, making it okay to say what you said was racist. And maybe to go back to my question before, maybe it's not so much you are a racist, because I think that accusation is problematic, but what you said, what you did, what you are planning to do in voting for Trump is racist.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Candace.
I just want to reset everything and let everybody know why we're here. Candace Dodson Reed is here. Tom Cole is here. Ryan Miner, Mark Steiner, and, of course, my partner, Don Moeller. We are doing an election palooza sort of throw-in. We weren't sure where this was going. I guess episode one is race. We'll get the lies in episode two and maybe policy in episode three. I'm not sure. But go ahead, Candace.
Candace and then Ryan.
Yeah, no, I was just agreeing with what my partner said in that maybe that's too strong in what I'm saying and trying to meet people where they are. And I shouldn't have to do this and back up and say that. But like, you know, at the beginning of the show, I'm saying that you are racist if you vote for Trump. You're doing a racist thing if you vote for Trump. And
I want to come back to that. But Ryan, I want you to jump in first.
So yes, I want to throw a curveball at y'all. And I think this could lead into a bigger discussion and we'll touch on it in a subsequent episode.
Episode four. I'm keeping notes.
In episode four.
It's like a Star Wars trilogy here, right?
Have you,
oh, Ryan,
in the last few days or the last 24 hours, the 7th District Republican candidate, Kimberly Clasick, released an ad that now has gone viral according to social media standards of going viral. The president touched on it. And I look at Kimberly Clasick as the perfect representation of a Trump voter. So not prepared, unskilled in policy. I interviewed Ms. Clasick earlier this year, or maybe it was last year. I can't remember. And the interview was fine. She's pleasant enough. But when you get into policy questions, she just can't answer basic questions. There's no historical background knowledge about issues that are important with respect to federal issues. But Ms. Clasick is in this ad and she's nicely dressed. And look, I put a post up yesterday. If I had a production team and a couple of $1,000 to walk through the city of Baltimore and point out all the things that were wrong with it, then yeah, maybe I could make the ad go viral. But as the Baltimore Sun opined today in its editorial column, what solution has she offered? Trumpism is at the heart, is complaining, and it's a long litany of grievances with everything that they find detestable about how things should be but aren't, and it's coming up with no real practical solutions. Ms. Clasick embodies Trumpism to its core, although when she is pandering to Donald Trump or Fox or whatever 4 a.m. spot that we're supposed to watch with her on it, or OA, whatever that news network is that is like weirder than Fox. How do you explain that phenomena? And I don't want to psychoanalyze Kimberly Clasick because I don't have enough time to do it, but how do you justify her experiences as a black woman who has a position and a platform, a big one, 130,000 people on Twitter that she could reach out to, and she's using it to shill for Donald Trump when she could be really talking about issues relevant to Baltimore City and fixing a city and not just saying, well, we're going to blame Democrats. That's so easy to do. She doesn't get her hands dirty with real issues. And that, for me, is problematic.
You know, you asked, again, it goes back, and I know we're coming up close to end of the hour, and I think this has been a terrific sort of introduction to election 2020, because these issues that we're talking about really are, and I think Candace has bottom-lined it, it really is what it's all about. And when Joe Biden talks about, and maybe before we get off, we at least get a little bit of reaction as we're taping this, as we're recording this. It's in the middle of the Democratic convention, first virtual convention. Get folks' reaction to that. But when he talks about the soul of the nation, I don't think that's an exaggeration. And it's interesting. I've had a college friend come back and forth with me. He reacted to my latest blog where I talked about George Mahoney in the 1960s. Your home is your castle. And basically made the point that Candace is making, and that Donald Trump has one card to play. And what folks on the other side hate, their favorite response, you all have heard it 1,000 times. Why do you all always play the race card? They love that. Like, that's supposed to shut down the I'm sorry, you're right. We can't talk about race. It happens to be the only card in your deck, but we're not allowed to call it out. And I think that has to be central to the discussion. I do think, Ryan, going back to your question, I've equated it, and I've written about it a number of times. I think what he's really been masterful at tapping into is this resentment of everybody else being the others. Immigrants are the others. African-Americans are the others. Liberal Democrats are the others. And you know what, 40-some percent? You hate them. And I hate them too. So it's not, like you said, it's not solution-centered. It's not focused on what we can do to make things better. It's you hate them, I hate them, and we'll hate them together. And I remind people, before I turn to you and get some quick reactions on the convention so far before we get out of here, that Donald Trump has never, and this is what gives me hope, I won't relax until sometime in November when we know who the president will be, but Donald Trump has never once grown his base. In the final Gallup poll before the 2016 election, Hillary was ahead 46 to 43. That poll was pretty close to being on target in terms of a national poll. She won by 2.9 million votes in the popular vote. She came up 38 votes short in the Electoral College. But he was at 43. He's the first president in history, I believe, and someone will fact check us, who's never gotten to 50%. And I went back and looked at presidential elections back some two decades. And the only president to win that wasn't close to 50%, and it's an outlier, was Bill Clinton in the year when Ross Perot got 18%. So you have to sort of throw that one out. So a presidential candidate like Donald Trump, like Ms. Klasik, who simply want to tap into this anger and say, you hate them, I hate them, that can get you to 43%. It might get Donald Trump to 45 or 46. As I said to another group earlier today, it's hard for me to imagine that there's a voter out there who did not vote for Donald Trump in 2016, who's looking at what's happening and saying, you know what, I didn't vote for that guy, but he's done a hell of a job. I think I'm going to vote for him this time. I don't think that voter exists. They're just not out there. So with that, why don't we go around real quick, sort of a round table. Nestor, we'll come to you last and let you sort of shut it down. Candace, what's your reaction to the first virtual convention in history?
My reaction is tears. I think we first need to acknowledge that Vice President Biden and the presumptive nominee, I guess he's not the presumptive nominee anymore, he is the nominee.
Right.
Party chose a Black woman to be a Black and Asian American woman to be his running mate. It is history. It is remarkable. I was listening to a podcast where they were like, yeah, some people are saying, or I was reading something that said, some people are saying it was an easy choice. Not an easy choice. I don't care how popular Senator Harris is. That was not an easy choice to select a Black woman as your running mate, the first one in history, Black and Asian woman as your running mate, first in history. I'm beyond excited about that. I can remember being a little Black girl and having conversations, and I said this on our podcast with my father about, you know, you got to do better and be smarter and work harder, you know, just to show that you can do it. And what Senator Kamala Harris shows us is that you can do it, and shows it to me, and she shows it to, you know, my daughter, and there are other young women in the country who are moved by this selection. And I can't wait to hear from her. I think it's tonight. Is that tonight?
Yeah,
I think
tonight.
I can't wait to hear from her tonight. I love her husband. I love them. I'm a huge fan. And so it was a courageous show. And Tom
was she your candidate? Can I ask you that?
She was.
Okay, fair enough.
She was my candidate. And so I'm excited about it. I'm energized. I feel an energy that we haven't felt since 2008. And I'm hoping that that even with COVID and even with any kind of tampering that could happen and even with the foolishness in this country right now, that it has motivated people to try to do something or to vote so that we get something different than we have. And so I've loved the convention thus far. I think they've done a remarkable job for a remote convention. The sort of roll call last night, I was like, yeah. And then I saw Brandon Scott, and I was like, yeah, Maryland.
Brandon's hair's getting as long as mine.
We're having Brandon on next week, I think.
Oh, nice.
I loved the calamari, man, from Rhode Island.
Yeah, no, I thought it was.
I was in for the
We're
going to
compare hair is what we're going to do, man.
Mark Steiner, your reaction to week one here, yeah. Virtual convention.
It's interesting. It's for me, it's mixed. I mean, I was I love the nominating the vote. I thought that was great. It just showed a diversity that was beautiful about who we are as a country, and that was really lovely to watch. I'm looking forward to Kamala Harris tonight to see what she's going to say. I guess a couple of things that detracted it from me was, well, I think that I'm glad Kasich and the other Republicans were there. I think that's important. But the Democrats could do themselves some real harm if they forget the progressive wing of their party and don't appeal to them and don't allow them a voice at this convention. You know, people said AOC didn't say anything about Biden. Well, that's because she was nominating Sanders.
Right. And a minor detail, Mark.
Minor detail, you know. Why don't you let AOC and some of the others actually have 5 minutes to say what their vision is for this country, why they want Biden to win? We're not hearing their voices. And I think there's a real danger that the establishment Democrats could blow it if they don't understand how broad this has to be in order to beat Donald Trump, to excite people to come out. But having said that, I think we're in a moment, you know? And I think that this is probably the most important election of my lifetime.
No doubt. There's no doubt.
I mean, I remember in 2008, I was in Denver and covering the election and blogging, sitting with the Maryland delegation. And there was this black woman sitting next to me who was a delegate from PG County, and her husband, who was Guyanese, sitting next to her. And when Obama and his family got up there, we looked at each other and we realized we weren't sobbing or crying. Tears were pouring down our eyes. I mean, this black family could be in the White House. This is happening in America now after all we fought for. And so, and it's a similar feeling now, but different. Now it's like survival. Survival of our country is at stake. And that's what they're saying in this election. That's what some of the people are saying who've been speaking. That's what Michelle Obama's speech was brilliant. And that was just so powerful. It was moving. And the other, Kerry's speech and the others are warning us what's about to happen and we have to wake up. That's the message that has to get across. So, I'm looking forward to tonight.
Yeah.
See what happens tomorrow.
You.
Yeah.
Ryan, how about you? You're the biggest political junkie I know. I'm sure you've been glued to the TV.
I have. And I've been watching, and thank God we have Hulu at our house, and this is not an endorsement, but I'm glad we do. Mark, the moment that the tears down for me was the moment back in with respect to President Obama was in May of 2011 when President Barack Obama walks out with confidence to the podium and announces that Osama bin Laden has been killed by American forces. And as I watched that moment, I said, and I wasn't an Obama supporter at the beginning, and I looked at that, and I looked over, and I was working a part-time job. It was a Sunday night at Uno's Pizzeria in Hagerstown, just as a part-time gig. I looked over to the girl next to me, and I said, that's my president. And I just watched, and I said, this is just unbelievable. And ever since then, that just sort of captured me. As far as the convention, I thought Michelle Obama's speech was very pointed, and I thought that I agree with her in some respects. We hate the politics, but we have to. There's so much work to be done, and I thought the most moving portion of the Democratic convention so far was the young lady from Arizona who talked about her dad, Mark Anthony. Is it your Quiza? I don't know how to say his last name, but it was a gentleman who was 65 years old, and his only pre-existing condition, she said, was trusting Donald Trump, and he paid with his life. Of course, he got coronavirus and died in the ICU on June the 30th. Her address hit hard because we probably all know someone who has maybe been impacted by coronavirus. I've known people who have died from coronavirus, but her speech was a summation of the abject failure of this administration. And when you personalize it and you don't talk just about numbers, but you can actually talk about tangible consequences, she did that, and that moved me.
Thank you, Ryan. Tom, the other half of Elevate Maryland, before we go to Nestor, give us your perspectives here.
The lesser half. Yeah, so I sort of have a two-edged comment on it, and that is, one is how aspirational this is. It sort of contrasts it against the 2016 election. 2016 election was as much about why Trump is dangerous as it was why Hillary should be elected. It's somewhat unusual that you have such an aspirational election coming from the challenger. Normally, you say in elections, you need to fire that one and hire this one, and you need to make the case for firing that one. I think that Democrats are sort of presuming that the case for firing Trump has already been made, and Michelle Obama's speech, the John McCain Biden video, it's all about aspiration. The critique that I will bring with that is that our Muslim American friends are being underrepresented on the primetime platform. And these are people that have probably the greatest risk of a Trump reelection. And I think that needs to be noted, because if you were to do a fire him, hire him, fire Trump, hire Biden pitch, part of that would be saying that Muslim Americans, our friends, are at dangerous risk. And I don't think I'm being overdramatic by saying that. So I think it's important to know that, because I think one of the things that the DNC needs to be careful about when they are having this aspirational pitch is making it too much about white people safe to vote for Joe Biden. And I'm not saying that this is intentional, but excluding prominent Muslim voices from the primetime stage kind of tells me that there's an intention of saying, you have to vote for us. So we're not going to put you on the stage.
Hey, Nestor, one quick point before we throw it to you. Tom, that's timely. You made me, I love it when people make me recall my good friend, Kevin Kamenetz. And he had issue after issue with Donald Trump throughout the campaign. But I'll never forget him just coming into my office and almost just slumping in a chair. It was the day that Donald Trump announced the Muslim ban. And Kevin looked at me and he went, "My God, what are we doing as a nation?" Because Kevin had a real affinity for Baltimore County's Muslim community. It's quite large. And he was fond of them and they were fond of him. And I actually thought he was going to cry. He thought, we actually have a president of the United States who wants to ban Muslims from coming into our country. So thank you for triggering that memory for me. Nestor, there's no pressure, buddy. It's been a heck of an hour. Take us out of here with
election palooza. If we don't get locked up for taking something, I'm sure it's copyrighted out there. Don Moeller, Candace Dotson Reed, Tom Cole, Elevate Maryland, of course, Ryan Miner from Minor Detail, and the legendary Mark Steiner as well. I'll just say this, and I'll leave it. We went through literally race and LGBTQ issues early on. We haven't taken on lies and dishonesty and more than that. I think that what's happened with the post office and the dishonor of trying to steal an election in some way here, whether it was with the Russians and Rudy Giuliani and Roger Stone and pardons and Manafort and all that's come out, we've only really scratched the surface in the first hour. We're going to come back. We're going to have at least four episodes leading up to the election if Trump doesn't try to move the election. which will be that'll be episode 5, I'm sure, when we get to November for that. But I want to thank the team for putting this together and Don for putting this together, all of our sponsors as well. Taharka Ice Cream. I got the Wake and Bake here. I might as well feature the caramel crunch here, salted caramel ice cream with chocolate-covered honeycomb toffee. And you guys can't have any because you got to get it to Taharka. You got to Taharka and get that shipped to yourself. Fadley's, of course, with the crab cakes. We had Damien Hahn on last week. We're going to be shipping those crab cakes everywhere. And, of course, State Fair in El Guapo. Over in Catonsville. I'll be over there for some shrimp and grits and some chicken and waffles with that raspberry sauce. It's delicious and a jalapeno. Maybe this time next year, we'll all be able to get together and do that.
There you go.
That'd be a lot of fun.
And we'll celebrate. We will celebrate the victory that's going to happen in November.
We will have a celebratory podcast. Yeah, it's great. It's great seeing y'all. I can't wait for the next one.
I know. This
appreciate you guys. Also, a shout out to Jeff Moeller. Don't want to forget him at Moeller and Gary Realty. On behalf of Tom, Mark, Ryan, Candace, and former Baltimore County Executive Don Moeller and one-time high school guidance counselor, I am Nestor Aparicio. We are WNST.net, AM 1570 Towson, Baltimore. We're calm. We're local. Don't get any more local than this. And always, Baltimore positive.